From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
What's expected to be the largest protest during the Republican National Convention, United for Peace and Justice is marching on Sunday, August 29th, against the Bush agenda.
The battle for New York.
We at the National Lawyers Guild intend to provide legal observers and lawyers for people exercising lawful First Amendment activity and to prevent the police from criminalizing dissent.
The protests and direct action have kicked off in New York ahead of next week's Republican National Convention. This weekend alone, hundreds of actions planned. We'll speak with a number of the protest organizers about what's to come. Also, the revolution starts now. We're joined in the studio by musician Steve Earle.
Can music change the world? Music changes people's hearts and minds. The world is people, so yeah, music can change the world.
And we'll get the latest on the siege of Najaf in Iraq. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A ceasefire has begun in the Iraqi holy city of Najaf, ending 3 weeks of fighting between the U.S. military and backers of the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. The country's leading Shiite religious leader, the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, arrived in Najaf with over 10,000 supporters yesterday to meet with Sadr. Sadr ordered his Mahdi army to disarm and hand over the keys to the holy shrine. As part of the ceasefire agreement, the U.S. agreed to pull its troops out of Najaf. In addition, Sadr was guaranteed the right to participate in Iraqi politics, even though he was charged by the U.S. occupation authorities with murder. Meanwhile, the Iraqi Health Ministry reported 110 people were killed, 500 wounded in Najaf and Kufa yesterday. At least 27 Iraqis died in Kufa when mortars slammed into the city's main mosque. Another 20 people died when a Shiite crowd marching to Najaf came under fire. President Bush has admitted for the first time that he has mismanaged the handling of Iraq after the fall of Baghdad. In a rare admission of a mistake, he told the New York Times he'd made a, quote, miscalculation of what the conditions would be in post-war Iraq. Since he appeared aboard the USS Abraham Lincoln May 1, 2003, under a banner that read Mission Accomplished, 828 U.S. soldiers have been killed in Iraq, six times as many as the number killed during the so-called major combat operations. In addition, more U.S. soldiers have now died in 2004 than all of last year in Iraq. In other Iraq news, members of the Iraqi resistance are suspected of sabotaging 20 oil pipelines in southern Iraq, cutting exports from the region in half. According to the Institute for the Analysis of Global Security, there have now been over 100 attacks on Iraqi pipelines since June 2003, when the organization began running the website Iraq Pipeline Watch. In Iraq, an Italian journalist who disappeared last week has reportedly been executed. Enzo Baldoni was shown yesterday on Al Jazeera being held by a group calling itself the Islamic Army in Iraq. The group had said they could not guarantee Baldoni's safety unless Italy announced plans to withdraw its troops from Iraq. Italian President Silvio Berlusconi condemned the killing but said he would not consider withdrawing Italian troops. For the third time in a row, the number of people living in poverty or without health care in the United States has increased. The official poverty rate rose from 12.1 to 12.5%, and the number of people living in poverty increased by 1.3 million. There are now nearly 36 million living in poverty, 45 million without health insurance. Child poverty also increased, and women's income in relation to that of men dropped from 2002 to 2003. Actor Danny Glover was arrested Wednesday during a protest on the steps of the Sudanese embassy in Washington, D.C., in an effort to highlight the Sudanese government's complicity in the humanitarian crisis in the Darfur region. The embassy closed its doors this Monday after weeks of protests and arrests. Russian officials are now saying that at least one of two simultaneous plane crashes on Tuesday was caused by a, quote, terrorist act. Traces of explosives were found amid the debris of one of the planes. An Islamic group claimed responsibility for the crashes in a website statement. In addition, investigators are also checking the identities of two Chechen female passengers whose bodies have been the only ones on the plane not claimed by relatives. For the second time in 3 months, a federal judge has ruled a ban on late-term abortions is unconstitutional. The New York-based judge criticized the Partial Birth Abortion Ban Act for not containing an exception to protect a woman's health. For the first time, former Chilean dictator Augusto Pinochet could be brought to trial for the death of thousands of Chileans in the 1970s. Chile's Supreme Court yesterday stripped Pinochet of immunity from prosecution. More than 3,000 people were killed for political reasons under Pinochet's rule after he led a bloody coup overthrowing the democratically elected leader, Salvador Allende. And media giant Clear Channel, which is known for sponsoring pro-war rallies, is holding a pro-heterosexuality rally this weekend. In Raleigh, North Carolina, the Bob and Shogram Show is holding what is called a Straight is Great rally this Saturday.
Jimmy joined the army 'cause he had no place to go. 'Cause ain't nobody hiring around here since all the jobs went down to Mexico. I reckon that London silver trade made me see the world. Move to the city someday and marry a black-haired girl. Somebody somewhere had another plan. Now he's got a rifle in his hand. He's rolling into Baghdad, wondering how he got this far. He's just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war. Bobby's got an eagle and a flag tattooed on his arm. Red, white, and blue to the bone when landing Kandahar. Left behind a pretty young wife and a baby girl. Stack overdue bills and he went off to save the world. It's been a year and he's still there, chasing ghosts in the thin dry air. Meanwhile back at home, a finance company took his car. He's just another poor boy off to fight a rich man's war.
Steve Earle, Rich Man's War, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. Steve will be joining us later in the program. I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of you listening in or viewing the show or hearing it on the over the internet, www.democracynow.org. We move first to Najaf. A ceasefire has begun in the Iraqi holy city of Najaf, ending 3 weeks of fighting between the U.S. military and backers of the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. The country's leading Shiite religious leader, the Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, led a peaceful march into Najaf with over 10,000 supporters yesterday to meet with Sadr. Sadr ordered his army to disarm and handed over the keys to the holy shrine. He told them, quote, "To all my brothers in the Mahdi army, you should leave Kufa and Najaf without your weapons along with the peaceful masses."
Dozens were seen to put down their weapons, while other militia members are believed to remain armed. As part of the ceasefire agreement with the United States, the U.S. has agreed to pull its troops out of Najaf. In addition, Sadr was guaranteed the right to participate in Iraqi politics, although he was charged by the U.S. occupation forces with murder. Rahul Mahajan is on the line with us, independent reporter, author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. Can you talk about the significance of what's taking place right now in Najaf, Rahul?
Well, putting together various sporadic reports, it looks like this whole offensive has involved killing at least 700 Iraqis, maybe up to 1,000. It was a largely unprovoked offensive by the United States. And the significance of this resolution is, I think, it is a stunning political defeat for the United States. It has massively re-legitimized Muqtada al-Sadr. It has forced Ayatollah Sistani, who is less of an opponent, at least to the occupation, than al-Sadr. It has forced him into a position where he was required to come back in order to maintain any kind of credibility. And the withdrawal of U.S. troops from the main part of Najaf after spending several weeks pounding them into rubble is going to have much the same effect that the siege on Fallujah in April, followed by the U.S. withdrawal, has had there.
We're talking to Rahul Mahajan. What about the number of people who died yesterday?
Well, the various reports, 74, 110 in several different incidents. There was an artillery shell that hit the main mosque in Kufa. There was a massacre, at least according to reports, of peaceful demonstrators marching from Kufa to Najaf. And some of the numbers also include Mahdi Army people killed in fighting.
Is there any clarity as to whether the U.S. troops have pulled out of Najaf yet?
As far as I understand, they've simply pulled back to the outskirts of Najaf rather than out completely.
And the significance of Sistani and Sadr meeting and what role Sadr will play?
Well, Sistani, in my view, made a miscalculation by going to London and appearing to wash his hands of the whole matter. Now, what his health situation really is difficult to ascertain. But a lot of people on the ground were looking at this and saying, Sistani is gone. The center of Najaf is under assault, because it was not just an assault on the Mahdi army. They closed off the center of the city and subjected it to repeated shelling. And people were starting to call Sistani a coward. In fact, in order to maintain credibility, he had to come back. The agreement involves basically no concession by Muqtada al-Sadr. In order to get the few hundred Mahdi army militiamen holed up in the mosque out, in order to even allow them to disperse into the community, they had to turn in the weapons that they were stockpiling in the mosque. But it doesn't mean any kind of disarming of the Mahdi army. I mean, every shopkeeper in the country has a Kalashnikov. You can buy a rocket-propelled grenade for $20. This is all of the concessions Sadr made are purely face-saving for the Alawi government and the United States, and the real loss here, I think, is for the occupation.
Rahul Mahajan, independent journalist, author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. This is Democracy Now! Juan?
We're moving now to the RNC protest. The protest action here in New York has kicked off in dramatic fashion ahead of next week's Republican National Convention. Yesterday, a group of activists used cables to scale down the side of the famous Plaza Hotel in central Manhattan and hang a massive banner. The banner had two arrows facing in opposite directions. One arrow was labeled Bush. The one pointing in the opposite direction was labeled Truth. The activists that carried out the action called themselves Operation Sybil and described themselves as a concerned group of students and professionals. Police were slow to respond, and by the time they arrived on the scene, the banner was ready to be unfurled. Police attempted to rush up with a team of specialists with climbing gear and stop the banner from being dropped, but they were too late. The banner hung for about an hour before police took it down. Evan Thies, a spokesperson for Operation Sybil, describes the action.
Today's action was about reaching out to undecided voters all across the country and getting the message out that ordinary people are willing to do extraordinary things to get rid of George Bush. The people up there today were a lawyer, a minister, an architect, and a small businessman, all from diverse backgrounds from across the country, Texas, New York, Ohio, that came together just for this one action, this one day, to get out the one message that Bush is deceiving the American people.
That was Evan Thies from Operation Sybil describing the banner drop yesterday at the Plaza Hotel. Just one of the many actions now underway in New York. Over the next week, there'll be literally hundreds of actions, rallies, marches, various disruptions of the convention. Today, we're going to look at some of those actions planned for the weekend. We've invited a number of people representing different organizations, but we will start with Hani Khalil, organizing coordinator for United for Peace and Justice. Hani, it seems that all of the attention has been to whether or not you will have a proper permit to march. What is happening on Sunday?
Well, it's been a phenomenal battle. We've been negotiating with the police and putting pressure on the city for more than 6 months to be able to have a safe and permitted rally. And in an effort to discourage people from attending what really could be the largest march during the Republican National Convention, the city actually told us that the only place that we could end our march with a rally would be on the West Side Highway. And it was either going to be the West Side Highway or no way. We think that we had thought that the Central Park was the most important or the best venue for us to do this march or to end the march. And so we fought that through every means we possibly could, including a lawsuit. Well, we didn't win that lawsuit. We're not going to Central Park, but we are thrilled to be able to announce that 6 weeks after being told we couldn't go anywhere but the West Side Highway, we're ending our march on Broadway. And so we're going to have a safe and permitted rally. We're looking forward to having elderly folks, parents, children, immigrants be able to participate in this march without fear of being attacked by the police or otherwise getting into conflicts. We're going to be assembling at 10 a.m. in Manhattan at 7th Avenue and 14th Street, kicking off the march at noon, north on 7th Avenue, heading east on 34th Street, south on 5th Avenue, and winding down on Broadway till we end the march at Union Square at 14th Street.
Now, we...
I wanted to ask you whether there was unanimity among the members of the coalition on that, or whether there are some that still feel that the march should have attempted to go to Central Park anyway and risk the possibility of confrontation.
Well, we've had very broad-based consultation with member groups of United for Peace and Justice in New York and elsewhere as to how to move forward in the event that we were denied a permit for a rally in Central Park. And people overwhelmingly feel this is a major victory. The truth is that after it became clear initially that the city didn't want us to go to Central Park, we put other options on the table, including going to Times Square, 3rd Avenue, and so on. Every one of those was rejected. Why? Because the city and the Republicans don't want us anywhere close to where the Republicans are going to be, because it'll make it harder for them to get out their message and for us to be able to put forward our message of peace and justice. So by what we're going to be, in effect, doing is we're going to Midtown Manhattan. That's where we're going to be. That's a major victory. We're going to be on 5th Avenue, where, for folks who aren't from New York, it's been years since people have been able to march on 5th Avenue.
Martin Stoller, attorney, do you think that it is less safe for people to march where they're marching than if they could have been contained in Central Park. Do you think the point is to provoke a confrontation with the protesters? It seems the easiest thing to do would be to have them in Central Park on the Great Lawn. You form a military, a police cordon around them if that's what the authorities want to do. And that's the end of it, as opposed to being to setting up this other situation.
I would have thought so. What they wanted to do on the Great Lawn was hold a rally with stages and speakers and amplified sound. What is going to happen, however, is only that there's going to be a march, and the march will disperse at Union Square without a rally, without speakers, and without sound. Hopefully, because the police are allowing people to move and to march, there will be no arrests. It's the same as there was last March 20th, when UFPJ organized a march and people were allowed to march down Broadway. There were very, very few arrests that were done, as opposed to February 15th, when the police penned people in and drove horses into the crowds, and then there were hundreds of arrests. In any event, it's a rally, or it's a march that is permitted. There will probably be police along the way to facilitate the march, but hopefully there will be no arrests. In any event, we at the National Lawyers Guild will have our green hats out there as legal observers to make sure that there is no police violence against peaceful protesters. And we have our teams of lawyers who are prepared to deal with people who
are
arrested.
What are people's rights?
People have an absolute right to march, particularly the permitted march. You have a First Amendment right to march. You have a First Amendment right to protest. You have the First Amendment right to ask your government to redress your grievances. The problem that has gone on in recent years is that there has been what the National Lawyers Guild's report now has just come out. There has been an assault on free speech, public assembly, and dissent. This report is just out. It's 100 pages written by the Guild's executive director, Heidi Boghossian. That's available from the Guild. It's also available to download. And it documents how dissent has become criminalized, how the First Amendment has been chipped away at by both the federal government and various state governments. That's something we can't allow. And that's one of the reasons why it's so important for United for Peace and Justice and other groups and organizations to be able to exercise their First Amendment rights. Hopefully here in New York, we still have a First Amendment, and the Lawyers Guild and our observers and lawyers will be out there trying to protect it.
Well, in your interpretation of the negotiations between United for Peace and Justice and the police, will individuals be able to go to Central Park if they do want to go? Or?
Absolutely. Central Park is open to anybody who's in New York City.
We heard Leslie Kagan, one of the coordinators of United for Peace and Justice, say she's going to Central Park for a picnic after the rally.
The only thing you won't be able to do in Central Park is use amplified sound, because to use amplified sound, you need a permit.
Well, absolutely. People obviously have the right to assemble and to engage in all kinds of activities in Central Park, to picnic, to dance, to do anything they want to, including to express their political views. And so people are going to be able to do that. And so we support their right to do that, including our own right to do that. We're just simply asking people to participate in our march. And after the march ends, to then, if they want to go home, that's fine. If they want to go to Central Park and engage in whatever kind of activity they want to do, we encourage that.
And what does the Lawyers Guild advise people, given the enormous clampdown now throughout New York City by the police, in terms of when you're stopped, police asking you for ID, when you're prevented from going into particular areas, what are you advising citizens to do?
Well, when you're stopped and asked for your ID, you don't necessarily have to provide it. There is no law that says you have to cooperate in anything. You can just walk away saying, no, thank you, I declined to give you my ID. If you're arrested, then it's a wise thing to have a photo ID, because then there's a possibility of getting a desk appearance ticket and not spending 24 to 36 hours in the system and in the cells. The police have set up a special holding area at Pier 57 on the 11th Street over by the west side, where they're not going to use central booking. They're holding people on the pier, and then they'll bring them down to the tombs and put them through the system unless they give desk appearance tickets. And we have been meeting with both prosecutors and the police around this to try to urge them to please give desk appearance tickets instead of clogging up the courtrooms. The judges, however, are ready. They've added extra arraignment parts, both day and night arraignment parts, and we're ready for that too. with the assistance of the People's Law Collective from New York and the Midnight Special Law Collective, who's coming from San Francisco to help us out. The Lawyers Guild office is a beehive of activity getting ready for what we hope does not happen, but I anticipate it might.
Well, we're going to hear from different groups who are going to be involved this week. And I want to thank you, Marty Stoller, president of the New York chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, and Hani Khalil, who is the organizing coordinator for United for Peace and Justice. And we will be there covering the rallies this weekend and be bringing you those broadcasts over this next week. We thank you very much for being with us. Pacifica will be broadcasting all through Sunday. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll hear from a number of the organizers who are participating this weekend. Stay with us. Steve Earle here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. He'll be joining us later in the program. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we talk with organizers from around the city who'll be involved in actions this weekend, beginning with Partha Banerjee, a kind of speak out today on Democracy Now!, immigrants' rights activist joining up with the United for Peace and Justice March on Sunday.
We are asking all immigrants to come out and be a part of this historic march on Sunday, August 29th. Immigrants are going through a very, very difficult time, especially since 9/11. Detentions, deportations, massive special registrations, thousands of hate crimes, loss of jobs, loss of health care. They are really, really tearing apart their lives. And this is really the opportunity when immigrants can voice their protests. They can voice their anger. They can voice their frustration, not just against this Republican Party or any other political party. This is not about any party. This is really about a system that sustains and thrives on lies and propaganda and fear.
And the action you are going to be doing?
We are asking all immigrants to fearlessly come out and be a part of the United for Peace and Justice rally. on Sunday, and we are asking them to assemble on 22nd Street between 7th and 8th Avenues. This is the location, a very safe and secure location that United for Peace and Justice has given us, and this is going to be very safe for immigrants because it's going to be sandwiched between a group of veterans for peace and a group of labor for peace. So I think it will work out very well, and they should all come out.
We're joined next by Joan Mallon, who's with the Rally for Women's Lives at City Hall Park, which will be on Saturday.
On Saturday morning, we're going to be marching. This is a pro-choice march to show that this city and this country is pro-choice. We will march across the Brooklyn Bridge, starting in Cadman Plaza, and then rallying at City Hall Park. The threats to women's health and rights are very real. This is an anti-choice administration with an anti-choice Congress paving the way to an anti-choice judiciary. And their assaults include ban on abortion legislation, which was passed last year, but cuts in family planning, promotion of abstinence only until marriage, sex education, and denying access to emergency contraception. So we must do everything that we can to ensure that women's health and women's rights remain, and that the services that Planned Parenthood provides and that people rely upon every day can continue to be provided in this city and in this country. Yesterday, a federal judge declared abortion ban legislation unconstitutional. And we were pleased with that decision, but we know that these assaults are going to continue, and we know we need to do everything that we can to assure that we have a Supreme Court that will continue to affirm women's rights and that the services that we provide can continue to be provided for the women and families that need us.
And so your march again, time and place?
It's going to be Saturday morning starting at 11 o'clock at Cadman Plaza across the Brooklyn Bridge, and we will rally in City Hall Park.
And you haven't had any problems with permits on your march?
No, we've had actually tremendous support from the police department so far.
Joan Mallon, thanks for joining us. Silky Shah, organizer with the National Youth and Student Peace Coalition, on Saturday hosting the Books Not Bombs Youth Convention.
Yeah, it's a convergence, actually. We're bringing students and youth from across the country together, and we're going to be having issue workshops, strategy discussions, skill trainings. It's going to be all day long, and in the evening we're going to have banner making and puppet making for the UFPJ march the next day. We're going to be focusing on five Books Not Bombs agenda items, which are education, not empire, respect for our civil liberties, schools, not jails, peace, not war, and no more military recruitment. So it's going to be.
And where are you doing this?
It's going to be at St. Mark's Church on 10th Avenue and or 10th and 2nd Avenue. And we're going to be meeting with the youth contingent on Sunday morning before the UFPJ march at 18th and 7th.
And your convergence will be going on all day?
Yeah, all day. It starts at 9 a.m. tomorrow.
And on Sunday, what time are you meeting?
10.
Okay. We're joined next by John McDonough, founder of Cabbies Against Bush and the host of the WBAI program Radio Free Erin.
Well, I'm with Cabbies Against Bush. We're organizing yellow cab drivers for the 4 days during the convention to turn their headlights on and keep them on during the daylight hours and to shine the light on Bush and his policies. We're also asking passengers, when you get into the cab, tell the driver to turn on the lights. We have a lot of immigrant drivers. They might be a bit afraid to turn on their headlights because we've all heard of what the TLC, the Taxi and Limousine Commission, they picked up that terror of the Lower East Side, Mike Wallace, during the week. So if they're arrested, passengers, they could harass yellow cab drivers, but a yellow cab driver, if he's told to turn on the radio or turn on the air conditioner, he could also be told to turn on his headlights. So it's very important that passengers in New York City, protesters coming in, tell your driver, turn on the headlights. You want to be part of the protest. As far as yellow cab drivers, we're going to have the lights on. We're also handing out coupons to any Republican delegate who, during the 4 days of the convention, in a fit of patriotic urge, wants to go fight the war in Iraq, we will give them a free ride to the airport. We kicked it off with a press conference in front of Fox Television on Monday because during an interview with Michael Moore, Bill O'Reilly stated to him that he wouldn't send his kids to fight in Iraq, that he would go to fight in Iraq. That brought a tear to my eye. So I figured if he's going to be that patriotic and fight in Iraq for my freedom, the least I could do was give him a lift to the airport. We went down there, we handed in a coupon, and as far as I see, Bill O'Reilly's still there. But if Bill, if you're listening, we have a yellow cab waiting for you and Sean Hannity. We were going to do the same with Rush Limbaugh, but he's a drug addict, and he probably couldn't. We don't want to be sending drug addicts over to Iraq at the moment.
And John, the TLC in a rare moment apologized for the Mike Wallace incident. Is this a new era of compassionate enforcement?
As I stated, I would rather be an Al Qaeda member in Guantanamo Bay in front of the tribunal down there, in front of the TLC commission, and having the court system that they have here. They have more justice down there. When we appear before the TLC, it's just
this
automatic.
Is the taxi and limousine.
The taxi and limousine. They have their own private court system where there's no media or anybody allowed into that. So if they're arresting passengers like Mike Wallace, who lunged at the TLC and was arrested, you can only imagine what they're doing to yellow cab drivers.
Hmm. Now, this news conference that you had in Monday has, I hear that you will be appearing on Fox today.
Allegedly, they're going to send a car service. I would have preferred a yellow cab, but they're going to send a car service to bring me to Fox Television at 4 o'clock today. And I hope to hand out plenty of coupons to all the patriots that are at Fox Television. And we'll line up the yellow cabs and take them to the airport. And good luck, because I'll sleep better at night knowing that Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity are fighting for my freedom.
What time can we see you on Fox today?
4 o'clock.
John McDonough, founder of Cabbies Against Bush, host of the WBAI program, Radio Free Erin. And finally, Brandon Neubauer, organizer with Time's Up, an all-volunteer environmental group that helped organize the first critical mass bike ride. Brandon.
Yes, the first critical mass bike ride in New York City. And for the RNC, we've actually organized something called the Bike National Convention. And that's been going all week. Some of the more popular rides that are coming up are our bike blocks, which are being held in solidarity with the United for Peace and Justice March. We're meeting 11 a.m. Union Square South this Sunday, and also 4 p.m. Union Square South on Tuesday in solidarity with the A31 Day of Direct Action and Nonviolent Civil Disobedience.
And, Brandon, we keep hearing that the city of New York is engaged in a crackdown on bicycles these days.
Well, it's funny because critical mass in New York has existed for 10 years. Time's Up helped get it started. But it's not our ride. We don't organize it. It's a spontaneous coincidence held in over 300 cities all over the world. And when the cops have showed up, they've essentially facilitated the ride, helped us block traffic, and it seems that they're trying to make a move and essentially issuing threats and instilling fear to try to keep people from showing up. And it does look like it'll still be the largest critical mass in New York City history. We've regularly been getting more than 1,000 people on
Brandon,
that ride.
Brandon, explain what critical mass is.
Sure. Critical mass is a gathering of people coming together at the same time and place, typically bicyclists and skaters. And it's we ride as a group, and we typically tend to go through red lights, and it's a way to create a temporary autonomous zone and a little bit of the world as we would like it to be, essentially sort of very much flying in the face of car culture and the oil wars that they require. And anyone that's participated in it pretty much has to go every month, because it's one of the most enjoyable, joyful expressions that you can participate
in. How many of you ride at once?
Starting last year, we started getting more than 1,000, getting up to 1,200, 1,500 people. We go up 6th Avenue or any major avenue. We stretch more than 20 blocks, which is a mile. And this, despite the threats of the police department, I'm expecting this tonight's ride, which is a 7 p.m. Union Square North, to be awesome. And the reason why the cops are cracking down on it is because they know it's such a source of spirit for the people involved.
And there will be activities every day during the convention week?
For the group that I'm organizing with? Well, we've been doing the Bike National Convention, which has been, we've been having events like the Paula Revere's ride, which was last Tuesday, and then last night, the DNC to RNC march, the welcome ride. And the main rides again that are coming up are the bike blocks, which are Sunday, 11 a.m. Union Square South, and Tuesday, Union Square South, 4 p.m.
What time is tonight's?
Tonight is, as always, critical mass is 7 p.m. Union Square North. Time's Up, again, Time's Up, you know, doesn't organize that ride. It's organized by everyone that shows up. Everyone can speak for it. And it's very much an embodiment of the global justice movement in terms of decentralized actions and people taking responsibility for themselves.
And did the police say they will stop tonight's?
You know, it depends on who you talk to. The police essentially have said that they're going to arrest people that violate traffic laws, which I find pretty ironic because essentially
anybody who goes to a red light or doesn't have a light on their bike.
But for the last 3 years, whenever the cops did show up, they essentially helped us go through red lights and helped it run more smoothly. So
Well, we'll keep tabs.
Yeah.
Brandon Neubauer, organizer of Time's Up, an all-volunteer environmental group helping to organize, who Brandon himself organized the first critical mass bike rides here in New York. And some of the organizers we've just heard from around the city who are planning for this weekend's convergence of, we'll see, thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. Our next guest will be Steve Earle, the musician.
It's Christmas time in Washington. Democrats rehearsed getting into gear for four more years. Things not getting worse. Republicans drain whiskey neat. Thank your lucky stars. They said they cannot seek another term. There were no more FDRs. And I sat home in Tennessee, staring at the screen, an uneasy feeling in my chest, wondering what it means. So come back, Woody Guthrie, come back to us now. Tear your eyes from paradise and rise again somehow. If you run into Jesus, maybe he can help you out. Come back, Woody Guthrie, to us now. Followed in your footsteps once, back in my traveling days. But somewhere I failed to find your trail. Now I'm stumbling through the haze. But there's killers on the highway now, and a man can't get around. So I sold my soul for wheels that roll. Now I'm stuck here in this town. So come back, Woody Guthrie. Come back to us now. Tear your eyes from paradise and rise again somehow. If you run into Jesus, maybe he can help us out. Come back, Woody Guthrie, to us now. Foxes in the hen house, cows out in the corn. Our unions have been busted, their proud red banners torn. But if you listen to the radio, they tell you all is well. But you and me, Cisco, no, it's going straight to hell. So come back, Emma Goldman. Rise up, old Joe Hill. The barricades are going up, and they cannot break our will. Come back. back to us Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. We're marching in the Selma while the bells of freedom ring. And come back, Woody Guthrie, come back to us now. Tell your eyes from paradise, rise again somehow.
Christmas in Washington, here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, 9-time Grammy nominee, Steve Earle, performing last night at an event for the Artist Network of Refuse and Resist, and right here in our studios this morning. Juan?
Well, the Republican Party has announced the soundtracks for its convention. Most of the musical performances for the Republican delegates will be country western musicians. But one Texas musician who was not invited is Steve Earle.
That's right. Steve Earle has begun hosting a radio show on Air America Sunday nights. His new album is called The Revolution Starts Now, and he does join us in our studio. Welcome, Steve.
Good morning.
It's good to see you. Well, what about this, the RNC soundtrack? Where do you fit in?
Well, I don't. And, even if I did fit in, I probably wouldn't show up. People's politics, there's a little, you're going to see more artists that, you know, that think more like I do. And by artists, I mean, artists with a capital A. And the recording industry definition of artist is a singer. And in Nashville, I've lived there for 30 years. And for the most part, you're dealing with people that the vast majority of them aren't singer-songwriters. There are some that are. But there's a whole lot more people out on the road, I think, on the other side in the run-up to this election than there are, out playing for the Republicans.
And you grew up in Texas and developed your how did you develop your in terms of your own political awareness and your political consciousness?
I came from just sort of a, it's when I grew up in Texas. I came from a long line of just old-fashioned yellow dog Democrats. But I was 14 years old and already starting to play. I was just a little precocious when it came to, what I ended up doing for a living. And I was too young to play places that served liquor, so that meant coffee houses. And the Vietnam War was going on, and San Antonio is a military town, 4 Air Force bases plus Fort Sam Houston when I was growing up. And it sort of polarized the community. Wars do that. Where I was hanging out was a pretty politically active atmosphere. So I sort of came by it honestly. It never occurred to me to separate issues and music. I just didn't learn to do it any other way. Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about your role in the play The Exonerated, about people on death row, performed by people who've been exonerated?
Yeah, I kind of watched that show being developed. Eric Jensen was there last night presenting an award at the award show, and we've gotten to be friends over the course of that. One of the people that is portrayed in The Exonerated is Sonny Jacobs, who's a very dear friend of mine. I met her doing work against the death penalty. She was convicted of a murder that she did not commit in Florida, and along with her husband, and her husband was executed for that murder. They were convicted on the testimony of a person who was riding in the car with them that actually did commit the murders, and he testified against them, said that they had pulled the trigger, she did 17 years. She did 5 of that in solitary confinement, and her husband was executed. And Jesse Tafero was the guy that they had to pull the switch on 3 times and eventually set him on fire in the process. So it was a really brutal execution of someone that was not guilty. And The Exonerated it started out as a set of monologues that actors would deliver in the words. It was based on interviews and court transcripts, and it's a pretty amazing show. I attended the very first reading of it at the United Nations several years ago. I hosted a reading of it in Central Park about about a year after that. And then I actually, before it closed here in New York, I performed Gary Gauger's, the part of Gary Gauger here in New York, and then I played Kerry Cook, who's actually from my dad's hometown in Texas, in a production of it in Nashville.
You served time in jail.
I did about 4.5 months of a year sentence that for stupidity. I'm a recovering heroin addict. I'm the only person that ever got the time for simple possession first offense because I didn't show up for my sentencing hearing, which judges frown on in Tennessee or anywhere else.
You've written a song about the death penalty. You perform it a lot. Could you perform it here?
I've written a bunch of them, but over the years, which is how I got involved in the movement. I wrote one song years ago called Billy Austin, and then people started calling me. And then I got out of jail, and Tim Robbins called me and asked me to write a song. He sent me a rough cut of a movie called Dead Man Walking and asked me to watch it and see if it inspired anything, which turned out to be sort of the understatement of that year in my life. I was fresh out of the service. It was back in 82. I raised some cane and I come back to town. Went in to be all I could be and come home without a clue. I married Dawn, had to settle down. So I just hired on at the prison. Guess I always knew it would. Just like my dad and both my uncles done. Worked on every cell block now and things were going good. Until they transferred me to this Unit 1. Swing low, swing low, swing low and carry me home. Now my daddy used to tell me about them long nights at the walls and how they used to strap them in the chair. Kids down from the college and they'd bring them beer and all. And when the lights went out, a cheer rose in the air. I guess folks just got too civilized. No spark is gathering dust. Cause no one wants to touch a smoking gun. And they got that injection now and they don't mind as much, I guess. They put them down on Ellis Unit 1. Swing low, swing low, swing low and carry me home. Now I seen them fight like lions, boys. I've seen them go like lambs. I've helped to drag them when they could not stand. And I heard their mamas crying when they heard the big door slam. And I seen the victim's family holding hands. Last night I dreamed that I woke up with straps across my chest and something cold and black pumped through my lungs. Even Jesus couldn't save me, though I know he did his best. But he don't live on Ellis Unit 1.
swing low and carry me home. Swing low, don't let go. Swing low and carry me home.
Steve Earle, here on Democracy Now, in our studio. Can't think help but think about Johnny Cash a little bit. And our listeners and viewers know we play the Mercy Seat a lot, and I don't know if you've heard about the Republican Convention, but on Tuesday, the GOP and the American Gas Association, a network of 154 utility multinationals, will be hosting an exclusive celebration for Cash for the Republican delegation of Tennessee inside the elite corridors of Sotheby's Auction House. Cash, a Republican?
John is rolling over in his grave. I promise you. Describing Johnny Cash as a Republican or a Democrat is like almost not appropriate. But I mean, he was one of the people that supported me more than anyone. One of the very first people to call, you know, with a call support after Jerusalem came out and all the stuff started flying around there about John Walker's blues. When I was locked up, he was one of three people that wrote me letters. You know, John was. Somebody asked him about me once, and he said, "Well, Steve's kind of like me. He's kind of a Indian in the white man's camp, and he was always an outsider in Nashville." And I find that offensive. I find that really offensive.
What about John Walker Lynn Blues? The controversy about it, and also could you play some?
Yeah, I mean what happened. I don't condone what John Walker Lynn did because I have a problem, you know, with anybody taking up arms against anybody for anything. But what I saw when I saw him on TV was a underfed 20-year-old kid, and I have a kid exactly the same age. I mean, he's my son's 2 months younger than John Walker Lynn, and so the first thing I thought was. My God, he's got parents, and they've got to be sick. You know, I mean, they hadn't heard from him in over 2 years, and the next time they see him, he's duct taped naked to a board on CNN.
Steve, we only have 2 minutes, so what we're going to do is I'm going to thank the people who made the show, and we're going to go out with this song. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke and Sharif Abdo-Kadous and Anna Nagar and Elizabeth Press and Jeremy Scahill and John Hamilton. Mike DeFilippo, our engineer, Uri Gallet, our director, Angela Alston, our technical director, and a whole host of people who make this program possible. So we will just fade out when we have to. We're going out with Steve Earle. I'm Amy Goodman here. Here with Juan Gonzalez. Steve Earle wraps our show.
I'm just an American boy, raised on MTV. I seen all them kids in the soda pop ass. None of them look like me. So I started looking around. Pull the light out of the dim. The first thing I heard that made sense was the word of Muhammad, peace be upon him. Ashhadu la ilaha illallah. There's no God but God. If my daddy could see me now, chains around my feet. He don't understand. Sometimes a man's got to fight for what he believes. And I believe God is great. All praise due to him. And if I should die, I rise up to the sky like Jesus, peace be upon him. Ashhadu
La ilaha illallah. There's no God but God. We come to fight the jihad. Hearts were pure and strong. When death filled the air, we all offered up prayers and prepared for our martyrdom. But I lied.